Welcome to Bespoke Investment Group's BespokeCast. I'm George Perks, macro strategist for Bespoke Investment Group. BespokeCast features conversations with markets professionals and economists whose views we find interesting or insightful into the world of finance and economics. If you like what you hear today, you can learn more about our firm by visiting our website, bespokepremium.com. Bespoke offers financial market research and insight to investors of all types, ranging from individuals to large institutions. You can follow us on Twitter at BespokeInvest. If you enjoy BespokeCast, we would also appreciate you reviewing the podcast in the iTunes Store or on your favorite podcast platform. Reviews help us gain visibility and also help us improve the podcast in future episodes. Welcome to BespokeCast for the week. We're really excited to have my personal friend and really talented and interesting, frankly, investor, Guillermo Roditi Dominguez of New River Investments here. He's a managing director, and I'm just really excited for this conversation because Guillermo is a fascinating presence online and has some really interesting stuff he's written over the years about the economy and investing. And it's awesome to get to sit down and talk to him for an hour. So he's joining us from his office in Los Angeles. Guillermo, welcome to BespokeCast.
Thank you, George. It's a pleasure to be here.
We always like to start with a little bit about you, your background, where you're from, and how you found your way into the investment industry. So where did you grow up?
I grew up kind of all over the place. I spent 11 years in Mexico City, a year in Barcelona and Spain before coming to the United States at age 12. And I was in Fort Lauderdale, Florida for 7 years before moving on to Boston, Massachusetts when I went to university.
And where did you go to university in Boston?
I attended Northeastern University. Was there from 2003 to 2008.
Heck of a time to be graduating from college right into the throes of the Great Recession.
Yeah, graduating with a degree in economics in December 2008 was, you know, one of the probably luckiest things that have happened to me, even if that sounds strange, because really made me examine, you know, what kind of path we're going to. There was really no jobs at the time, and nobody wanted to hire anybody out of college. So it really kind of forced you to open your horizons into different possibilities that you might have not otherwise considered.
And where did those different horizons, different possibilities end up taking you as you sort of assessed things in December of 2008?
By that point, I had spent a few years working with a broker-dealer, Cantell & Company in Boston. I had worked there in roles from operations in the lowest levels, you know, whether that be like, you know, literally picking up the mail on rainy days to doing some software development work for them. And I was lucky enough that at that point I had experience programming. I had, you know, plenty of years of experience programming. And so it kind of gave me, let's call it, an interesting intersection of skills where I was familiar with the brokerage business. I was a registered representative. I had passed a Series 7 and a Series 66, and I was able to code. So it made working on the IT side much easier when dealing with, you know, operations or trading or compliance.
Because you had worn similar hats before.
Correct.
You get out of school and you take this job doing coding and doing support work for a broker-dealer. You're now the managing director of a hedge fund. It's obviously a pretty big difference. So how did things sort of evolve? I mean, did you work your way up through the firm? How did that look?
Really, from 2007 to 2010, if you were working at a financial institution and you weren't really aware of everything that was going on and interested in it and learning more about it, then the field really was not for you.
Right. It was very much the wheat getting separated from the chaff.
Yeah, I think anybody that came out of those years not living and breathing capital markets figured out that they really needed to leave the industry and go somewhere else where, you know, they enjoyed their work a little more.
Right. And I still think I've come across people that are still not as passionate as I think you or I might be about the industry, but it definitely seems like being in it for the money, for instance, is something that's a lot less common these days than it was in the go-go years of the 1990s or 2000s.
Yeah, you know, the money isn't what I'm told it used to be. I never really saw it, so I can't attest to whether it was really that good or not. And it can be a really thankless job that can really chip away at you if you let it.
Yeah, definitely. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that later, about what it's like operating a hedge fund and what it's like for you, because I know you do a lot of stuff that most people who run hedge funds can't be bothered to do with regards to some of the nuts and bolts. But you are still this broker-dealer. You're involved in a bunch of different areas of the firm. You're quite passionate about it. That takes us to like 2010. So how did you end up out in Los Angeles at New River?
Yeah, I had the great idea of, you know, I told myself I was going to move out here. I planned it in advance, and I picked, you know, the weekend after the FOMC presser. I thought to myself, well, you know, I'll stick around until after Fed announces whatever they're going to do, and then, you know, I'll be able to leave that weekend so that I have a clear mind. Of course, I didn't know that was going to be the start of what we now know as the taper tantrum. And at that point, I was carrying a pretty large portfolio of instruments that were sensitive to interest rates, particularly municipal bonds. And, you know, it's stuff that is supposed to be very, very negatively convex.
So sorry, negative convexity is probably something we should talk about a little bit. Go ahead.
Basically, we had a portfolio of bonds that were supposed to not be sensitive to interest rate changes in the very short term, and to small changes. Obviously, there were going to be, you know, more sensitive to larger increases in interest rates, but they were less sensitive to small changes in the short term. However, that was a, you know, really large move, and I had the pleasure of moving here on a Saturday, and, you know, Monday, markets were moving 3%, which is, you know, a huge amount. And I was still waiting for FedEx to deliver, you know, my work computer. I was working out of a place where I got very bad cell phone reception. So I was literally just trading out of my phone, calling trading desks like it was like the 1980s or something.
I laugh because I know it worked out, but that actually sounds quite horrible. The idea of trying to work without a computer in a modern financial environment is just like crazy, right? I mean, that must have been terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, I have sheets that I use that I keep in a notebook where they're kind of like pricing sheets, where I, you know, kind of have where I want our exposure to be depending on where certain variables are. And I keep it in my notebook just written down or printed out because it's easier than having to look it up every time. I was lucky to have that because I didn't really have to, you know, try to recalculate everything that we had on. I could just kind of look at the sheet and get an idea of where we were and where we were trying to be. But it was interesting, you know, we traded probably, I'd say about 50% of our net asset value within, you know, in that week, when I really didn't have much access to anything. We were just, you know, we saw investment grade municipal bonds trading outside of high yield, and we were just trying to buy them as fast as we could before the opportunity dried up.
Right, and you had already had a fairly large portfolio of municipal bonds at the time, so, you know, really doubling down, in other words.
Yeah, doubling, tripling down. And it, I mean, you know, I really thought that we were going to have about a week, 2 weeks of that before everything started kind of coming back to normal. Little did I know that that 4th of July, which the 4th of July was Thursday and the 5th of July was Friday, there was nobody, you know, there was really nobody at work on Friday. And when the payroll, when the, you know, employment situation report hit, we had a huge beat on payrolls. Bonds just, I mean, yields just skyrocketed. And, you know, the some of the hedging programs for mortgages, you know, were, you know, putting on these big trades that were kind of pushing yields out further forward. And, you know, after that weekend, I thought that was it. You know, like we're long everything we could get. And it went on and on and on until December. It was a joke that you know, the back half of 2013 was, you know, basically getting waterboarded.
The capital markets version of it anyway. So your fund tends to be fairly fixed income focused. I mean, you know, so far we've talked about a muni position. You just mentioned mortgage hedging. I know you trade CMOs and other MBS. What sort of is it? Obviously, you shift around, but what share of your fund is going to be involved in fixed income at a given time, typically? Just to give people a sort of an idea of like what your basic, you know, setup is.
It's about 60 to 80%. Sometimes a little bit, you know, sometimes even more than that. And when it's on the low side, it's really more because we are in fixed income adjacent instruments. For example, something that we did in 2013 was buy closed-end funds of municipal bonds, where we could, you know, in addition to picking up the bonds for cheap, we were able to pick up a significant discount to the net asset value of the funds.
Just so people know, closed-end funds, the way to think about them, if you're not familiar, similar to an ETF, but instead of a creation redemption mechanism that arbs the ETF and keeps it in line with the value of the underlying assets, it's closed. So there's only a certain number of shares out. There's only a certain number of there's only a certain value of traded market cap out. So you can see distortions where the bonds will be marked at X and the implied value based on the market cap will be X minus Y, and Y is the discount. So you can, you know, that because there aren't creation and redemption of units in a closed-end fund, you get these pricing disparities, basically.
That's fairly accurate.
So not only were the bonds in the funds cheap, but there were also discounts on the vehicles as well, of like what size?
We had discounts into the teens, which is, you know, really large. The discounts really kind of come down to, you know, capitalized expenses and fees most of the time. But here we saw them really, really widen. And it was basically these funds were implying that the portfolios would have very, very strongly negative alphas. And at that point we thought, you know, that's fairly strange. You know, you have a portfolio of 400 positions. It's really hard to like land anywhere very far from the index, especially for investment grade bonds. Another benefit that there was is prime brokers can be really testy about whether they'll finance municipal bonds and like to what extent, because they tend to sometimes not be very liquid or trade very often. So, you know, you don't have a day-to-day trading history of them. Which
is that more so than corporate bonds too? Or
corporate bonds are much more liquid than municipal bonds. And so, you know, sometimes you get a trade in something, and you know that particular issue might have not traded, you know, in the last week or even the last month. Moving to the funds, in addition to giving us a little bit of extra juice, you know, we had the rest of our portfolio. It was unlevered. We really wanted to add some, you know, some financial leverage to it, because those opportunities don't come. You might see something like that happens once, you know, every 4 to 5 years.
Right. There certainly hasn't been any. I mean, maybe you could classify what happened post-election as sort of similar in the rate space, but not the same degree of carnage, because risk assets were going nuts too. So, very rare. So you also play a fair bit in mortgages as well, right? So can we talk a little bit about that? Because I know that's an interesting space.
Yeah, I would say I spend most of my time working on mortgages. We spent the better part of the last 5 years involved in legacy non-agency RMBS. So basically, loans that were underwritten between 2003 and 2007 of various credit qualities. And these are a lot of the securities that, you know, for a while were being called toxic securities. A lot of them ended up having, you know, very modest to minimal losses. And we were involved with buying them and you know, playing the credit for the last few years. The early part of those, I would say from 2011 to 2013, was kind of dicey. You still had we still had elevated levels of foreclosures and delinquencies. And, you know, you really did have losses coming through. And it was, on our side, it was a bet that the household sector was really, you know, had taken the brunt of their losses, and property values would stabilize or even increase, which at the time was really not a consensus view.
Yeah, we didn't see sort of broad consensus around housing prices starting to rise again until late 2012, maybe mid 2012 at the absolute earliest, when people started to say, okay, you know, we're gonna keep plugging back up. And I mean, now when Case-Shiller obviously is at an all time high, and households are still deleveraging in terms of, you know, if you do mortgage debt to GDP, which is a measure I know you're not necessarily wild about. Some of your colleagues at New River aren't wild about either, but just as an example, mortgage debt to GDP is still declining. The home equity market is still declining. So it's, you know, it's been a long trade running. I mean, what percentage of the outstanding value is left on some of those bonds that came out in the mid 2000s? Yeah.
Of the original value?
Like, what's the factor like?
I mean, if you took the universe as a whole, I would say that, you know, the factor is probably, the high single digits, maybe the low double digits. So much of that stuff is just gone. Either it got called away, the bonds got called and retired, or, you know, the losses came through. There's really not much product left.
Right. So in other words, of the, just to put it in plain English, of the, you know, if when the bonds are issued new, it's 100%, there's maybe 8 to 12, something like that, percent left that you can trade and take a position in. Everything else has either defaulted, paid down and gotten cleaned up, or, you know, rolled off in one way or another, as these bonds do.
Well, refinancing is really what did it in, right? We had, you know, the HAMP programs, the HARP programs, and, you know, anybody that had a decent credit score was able to refi into much lower rates. Got to remember that, you know, you had a 800 credit score, before the crisis, and you took a mortgage out, and you had, you know, you got the best rate there was, and you were paying like 6%, you know, sometimes more than that. So as interest rates came down, and the curve flattened, and, you know, Fannie, Freddie, Ginny mortgage rates came down, we saw basically the majority of mortgage debt transition to those. And so,
Right.
The bonds were paid off early.
Right. I mean, it's amazing that the bonds that at least the sort of senior parts of original securitizations that, you know, were so often pointed at as the you know, culprits of the crisis, many paid off at face value. You know, ultimately, you know, you can still take P&L losses if they pay down early and you don't get the coupon you were expecting. But still, I mean, in terms of credit quality, a lot of these things paid down and were money good, which is something that I think a lot of people don't really realize is that in many cases, even in the area of the market where it was most abused in MBS, securitization actually worked.
Yeah. You know, the system for tranching and structuring credit and prepayment risk is very robust, and a lot of times these securities get a bad rap for, you know, being called complex. Sometimes the models that are used to price them are complex, but the actually inner workings of these securities are pretty simple, to the point that, you know, you can really pen and paper, you know, draw a flow chart of this, and, you know, with minimal math get to, you know, get a very, very good understanding of how the cash flows will be distributed.
That doesn't obviously apply when we start talking about CDO squareds and synthetic CDOs and so on and so forth. So it's important not to sort of let us take that too far. But I mean, you know, for the original securitizations, it's
I would argue that sometimes you have complexity in, you know, the collateral that you are securitizing and how those pieces relate to each other, but the actual structure is for the most part pretty straightforward for, you know, whether they be mortgage loans or auto loans or credit card securitizations. These are structures that are really not complex. What is complex is, you know, the relationships between the loans that are securitized together and the models used to describe those.
So can you talk about that a little bit more, why that's complex, but the securities themselves aren't, just to expand a little bit? Because that's not intuitive.
Yeah, so the structure of the securitization, for the most part, when we're talking especially about credit structuring, you can, at its most abstract, think about it like a waterfall. You know, a waterfall with multiple tiers, and this is actually the language that we use when we describe them technically. You have a waterfall with a fountain with multiple tiers, and, you know, you pour water in at the top. You know, the first little bowl will, you know, fill up and spill over, and then that'll go to the next tier, and then that'll go to the next tier. It's kind of the same with cash flows. You know, you have cash coming in from people paying, you know, principal or interest, or a mortgage insurer paying out on a defaulted mortgage. And, you know, there's a certain precedence in who gets those cash flows. And once the people that are at the front of the line have gotten all their money back, then, you know, the next people get it.
So that's, speaking to structure, when you talk about how the models that price and describe the underlying collateral interact, can you talk a little bit about why that's more complex?
Most of the time when you'll take a large number of securities, and you will try to create a diverse mix of loans that are diversified across multiple categories. If you are doing homes, for example, you will try to include loans that come from many different metro areas, you know, so that you don't have all of the loans from, you know, some small town in California in one securitization. The reason you do that is because, you know, you never know what kind of local geographic effects, you know, you're going to have. For all you know, there ends up being, you know, a large chemical spill there that sours, you know, the property for the whole town, or the know, the municipality goes bankrupt and the services suffer and people no longer want to live there, or you get, you know, some kind of natural disaster. So you usually try to diversify across multiple geographies, and even afterwards, you know, people diversify across different factors. For example, whether this is a new purchase loan or it's a refinance loan, the size of the loan, whether it's a loan for an inexpensive home or a more expensive home, whether you borrowed a lower fraction of the home's value, or whether, you know, you put down a very small down payment and borrowed the majority of the home's value. And so you get kind of a diverse mix. And, you know, by this point, a lot has been written about these models. And the idea was basically that if you spread your bets around enough, you know, it was unlikely that everybody was going to have the same problem at the same time. But, you know, of course, that's exactly what happened.
One area of the securitization market that you have spent a lot of time looking at in recent years, as the subprime stuff has dried up and not been as available, is auto loans. So a lot of attention has gone to securitizations of all kinds of auto loans, but especially people are worried about a repeat of the subprime mortgage crisis with subprime auto loans, which I think you've shown, and I've, you know, I've looked at this a lot in our research too, and it's almost funny to think about the same, you know, putting them in the same ballpark. But could you talk a little bit about some of the misconceptions around auto loans and why, A, they're not the next crisis, and B, you know, they're probably not any kind of crisis at all?
Sure. So I would start by saying that you're probably going to hear the next iteration of subprime auto is going bad, you know, everything's happening like it did in 2008 again in the next couple of months, just because the, let's say, the middle part of subprime, you know, loans that are made to borrowers with not the lowest credit worthiness, but, you know, pretty damaged credit, exhibit very, very clear signs of a seasonality. People are more prone to default in the winter months, and then once they start getting tax refunds in, they, you know, they catch up with their bills. Usually you have a pretty good period of credit, you know, running into about June, and then after that, after the summer, you know, you get a spike up as people either have lower incomes, or sometimes people tend to find themselves overextended over the holidays through, you know, whether it be, you know, family obligations or unplanned expenses, or, you know, sometimes a lot of these people just, you know, their credit scores are low sometimes because financial literacy may be low, or they might not have the greatest spending habits. So, you know, we have this very clear seasonal pattern, and almost every year, like clockwork, you know, people say, hey, if you annualize the December numbers of subprime defaults, it looks like all of the loans are going to default. And then, you know, February comes around and everybody gets their tax refund checks, and it, you know, turns out that that wasn't really going to happen. There's just really not enough auto loans for them to create like a big damage to the economy. And as a percentage of the loans issued by banks, they're not that big. The home mortgage market, you know, was like a $20 trillion market. It was humongous. You know, the auto market is significantly smaller, an order of magnitude smaller. Another thing that you have to think about is with a mortgage, you know, in your first year, you know, you're paying basically all interest. So you're not really building much equity through the first few years of the loan, whereas auto loans tend to be significantly shorter. And so you're paying down, you're reducing your principal amount owed very quickly.
If I'm a skeptic who is saying, oh, well, you know, what about the fact that we're now seeing 6-7 year auto loans on vehicles that, you know, are used to begin with and have borrowers with shoddy credit history, it's inevitable that those are all going to go bad at some point. What's the response to that? You know, that borrower quality has declined, that terms have been pushed out, and that a lot of these are, you know, used vehicles that have higher mileage than traditionally, you know, auto lending has been focused on?
The extension of the loan term is something that we've paid a lot of attention to. But cars really do last longer these days. 7 years, a lot of people say like 7 years is just too long for a car, but a car will last 7 years. I mean, like, most cars of recent production can, you know, reliably give you 240,000 miles. So that's not really a concern. I think that's an argument people make, to look down on people who are not thrifty enough. I think, you know, when you're talking about a longer loan like that, you have to remember that those longer loans are not necessarily offered to people with, you know, like really, really low credit scores. Most of the lenders know what they're doing. The length of the term you can take will be limited by the age and condition of the automobile you're buying. You're probably going to have, you know, be putting in a down payment, which will limit the liability of the lender. And you have to remember that people will get really worried about used cars. However, it's much riskier, you know, lending a similar percentage of the car's value in a new car, because that car is going to depreciate a lot faster than an old car. That depreciation on a new car is much more front loaded. So if I was going to be worried about anything, you know, it would be prime borrowers and new cars. The subprime market in the auto space is actually, you know, relative to the economy, it's fairly small. The interest rates are high enough that for any particular ABS deal, the total losses incurred for, you know, the entire pool of loans pledged to the trust will in most cases be smaller at the end of the life of the trust than a single year's worth of interest payments.
So just to give a numerical example, so hypothetically, you know, you've got 100 car loans that, and in reality, obviously, auto ABS have a lot more loans than 100 loans that go into them. But
I mean, I can give you a pretty straightforward example,
okay,
right? So if you take the SDART securitizations, these are Santander Consumers securitizations.
They're what, number from, two or three in the subprime auto lending space?
They're the largest securitizer of subprime auto loans. From 2010 to 2017, the weighted average coupon, that's to say the coupon on the loans that, you know, these consumers are taking out.
So the interest share of the payment every month.
This is, you know, you're kind of including a principal payment in here. You know, this is, you know, like your coupon payment, but at the low end, about 15.6%, and at the high end, about 17.5%. And most of these were like in the mid 16s for the majority of these. By now, all of the securitizations issued prior to the second half of 2013 have been extinguished. That is to say, you know, they have paid in full and the bonds have been retired. And the highest losses amongst those, you know, were about 13.4, with most of them, you know, in between 11 and 12%.
And so again, it's 13.4% credit losses. Oh my God, that's a lot. That's a horrific number. Well, no, it's not, because it's throwing off 16% interest every year. So you can take losses like that and the whole structure still makes economic sense because the interest rates are so high. There's a right price for everything, in other words.
Yeah. And I think a lot of times people, you know, forget that, you know, whatever you're losing on the cars is, you know, really not, it's not that much compared to, you know, the work that it is to have somebody at a call center call you and be like, hey, I see that you didn't make your payment. Would you like to arrange to make a payment now? Annualized credit losses are actually a smaller factor to profitability than servicing and collection expenses.
So it costs more, just again, to use your example, it costs more to pay people to sit in a call center and remind folks to pay their bills than it does to say, okay, we're just going to take your car, sell it off, collect the difference between that and what you owe, and register some kind of loss. The call center costs more.
Well, I would say not quite. The servicing and collection expense is higher than the realized credit losses, but the realized credit losses are lower because they're investing in having these people call and collect on these loans, and there's also other roles that these servicing operations perform, such as taking payments by phone, or if somebody calls and they had a hardship, sometimes you can get these companies to give you a month or two before you make your next payment so that you can get back on your feet.
So the bottom line here with these auto securitizations is that they're not as big as people think they are. They're not as risky as people think they are, and they perform better ex post than people think they will, essentially. I mean, that's what it boils down to.
Yeah, with something like if people talk about a big short type of trade, one of these trades is going to just pay off huge and make you rich. Your window for getting that downturn right is incredibly small, and the downturn has to be incredibly large. Most of these bonds have a life of about 3 to 4 years. That's the entire securitization. If you are, let's call it, if you're short selling, the riskier bonds, the ones that would take the first losses on it, you would be shouldering a negative carry of 4 to 5%. So you really have to get it right very quickly. And if you were to go up to the higher ends of the capital structure, so that the senior bonds that are AAA rated, and you were to sell short one of those, you would basically need every single loan in the trust to default and be liquidated within 7 months, or else you wouldn't make money.
It's just amazing. I mean, that example is a perfect explanation of why securitization is such an interesting space, because you've taken these individually absurdly risky loans. A given individual is not a good credit risk. They're paying a very high interest rate, and you pool them together, and at the end of the day, you've created something that is basically as safe as it gets in fixed income. Maybe not literally as safe as it gets, but very, very safe, predictable cash flows in fixed income. You've squeezed blood out of the stone. It's really quite remarkable. And this is not like some sort of fantasy market that's just in its infancy. This is something that's been around for a long time and has, proven itself through a bunch of different market environments. You also play in mortgage securitizations of insured mortgages, so not subprime, but government-backed mortgages that have been turned into CMOs. Do you do any pools as well, or is it just CMOs?
No, we focus primarily on CMOs. Pools, they're very low risk, low variance, low return instruments that they don't necessarily fit the traditional profile of a hedge fund. Certainly not a hedge fund of our size. Maybe if you have a few $1 billion in capital and have access to some, to a larger sum of financial leverage from institutions and the ability to put on you know, some of these long short trades or basis trades, but we focus entirely on CMOs.
And the reason for that is that you're able to get more convex payoffs, sort of more esoteric stuff, without having to go to a bank and ask for a, you know, margin essentially.
I mean, the reason anybody is involved with a CMO is because you can fine tune them to get exactly the exposure that you want, and because if you lock a certain amount of, you know, risk or leverage into a structure, it, you're able to take on that risk without having to go out and, you know, create that financial leverage yourself, you know, by borrowing money from a prime broker, for example, which is, you know, significantly more expensive, or you may just, you know, really have no access to it, no matter, you know, whether you want to or not.
Could you give an example? And so we've talked about how securitization works in general. The proviso for CMOs is that there's no credit risk component. You're only playing with prepayment risk and the general interest rate environment. So it's not like an auto ABS where, or a subprime ABS where somebody could not pay and that affects the value of the bond from a credit perspective. So can you talk, like, give a simple example of a CMO, hypothetical, it doesn't have to be something you own or anything like that, but, and, you know, why you might want to own a specific kind of CMO in a given situation, just so people get a little bit of an idea what we're talking about here and how they can be customized.
Right. So I think the quintessential examples are that of an interest only and principal only strip, where, you know, whereas your cash flow coming in from a mortgage, usually, you know, you send in one check that includes both your principal and interest. Sometimes it can be divided, you know, at the security level, at the CMO level, and principal payments and interest payments are separated. The reason for doing that is because, you know, your normal 30-year mortgage, which can be refinanced, has an embedded option. And, you know, stripping those cash flows allows you to separate that option out. A buyer who believes that the number of refinancings is going to be low would probably want to buy the interest only tranche.
Just to walk through the logic there, if refinancings are going to be low, that means that people will be paying their interest for longer, which means owning the rights to the interest stream of payments is more valuable because you get the same, you get a longer term stream of interest payments than you would if people paid off their mortgages quickly, right?
Correct. And on the other side, you know, if you own a principal only, then if people were to refinance their mortgages more often than in, you know, the present or near past, then your bond would benefit because, you know, you would buy that bond at a discount to face value, and you'd get your money back quicker. That's an interesting thing about agency CMOs, right? We know you're going to get your money back. I mean, at least for the principal side, right? The only thing that is unknown is when you're going to get it back. And, you know, another type of, and this is probably the most common type of structuring, you know, in, all structuring of agency CMOs is prepayment structuring. But another one is what we called a PAC, which is a planned amortization class. And you might have a buyer, you know, a natural buyer of a fixed income securities, like, let's say, for example, a bank. And the bank wants, you know, wants to own these mortgages, but they say, hey, you know, I'm not interested in owning a bond that ends up being very short. I need my bond to have these characteristics. I can't have the life of it very, very wildly based on whether interest rates go up and down. And so you create a support class where, you know, if the payments, if the prepayments fall outside of a certain band, the support bond either, you know, gets the excess of prepayments or, you know, doesn't get, you know, a cash flow, so that cash flow can be diverted to the senior.
In other words, you're tailoring risk. So the bank is averse to risk and hypothetically New River is not. So New River takes the support structure and the PAC, the PAC stays with the bank and everyone's happier than they would be otherwise.
Yeah, it's a way to slice up risk and allow people who, you know, who don't want that risk to, you know, pass it on to somebody who is willing to take that risk and, you know, and trying to make a little extra money.
So I think it would be really great to finish up talking about what it's like operating New River. So New River is not just a hedge fund. You guys also do separately managed accounts for folks. You have colleagues in, three different states that work with you that have their own client bases. Could you talk a little bit about what it's like running a business? You know, what it's like having a relatively small team and not being able to just say, oh, well, our back office will handle that. I mean, you are in a lot of cases the back office, right?
Yeah, I would start by saying that, you know, running a business is not nearly as glamorous as you might imagine. Sometimes a lot of people have this idea of, you know, a lot of freedom and, you know, able to, you know, be your own boss and, you know, do what you want. The reality is that, you know, your computers have to be dusted, your papers have to be organized. Somebody has to go buy, you know, printer paper, make sure the toner's changed on the copier. You know, the floors need to be vacuumed. All that stuff needs to be done, you know. And if you know, if you're a small team, those duties are shared by everybody, you know. Making sure payroll is done, making sure, you know, your email is set up. All those little things are a small but, you know, vital and unseen part of running your own business. I think a lot of people don't remember that, you know. At the end of the day, you know, if you're out of pens, somebody needs to go online and order, you know, order new pens or paper clips or whatever it may be. As far as New River goes, and you know that what is probably of more interest to listeners, New River works in the form of an asset allocation committee. A lot of the assets that we manage fall into one of three variants of what we call our balanced portfolio strategy, where we use a committee approach to making investment and asset allocation decisions. And by that, I mean, we all fight over email for, you know, 4 to 5 hours, sometimes 4 to 5 days, over, you know, the merits and risks of various trades until we're, you know, until we come out to a place where we can agree that we can all live with it. We vote. You know, sometimes it means that what I think is a particularly brilliant idea gets shut down, or sometimes it means that what I think, you know, a particularly bad idea gets to live, and that's kind of it's kind of how it works. Everybody has a vote, and everybody's vote weighs the same.
So that's not the hedge fund. That is a separately managed account strategy, right? The hedge fund is separate, and then there are some other accounts that are separate as well, too.
Yeah, that's, I think, but, you know, in terms of, you know, what you've seen, our discussions online and some of the, you know, some of the internal research that sometimes we'll post so that outside, you know, people on the outside can take a look at it. You know, those are all of the inputs that go into, you know, these discussions where ultimately, you know, we may come out with a trade or we may not.
So a very collegial process compared to, you know, somebody just saying, okay, analysts, go get me some trade ideas and I'm the PM and I'm going to put them on.
That's correct. I mean, everybody has their models. Everybody contributes them. You know, one of the rules is that, you know, you don't get to propose a trade unless you have a model for it. It doesn't have to be like some very fancy mathematical model, but, you know, we need kind of an objective way of measuring the merits and the risks of every trade idea. And so we never, you know, trade on a whim where we're like, hey, you know, this feels good. Like, let's try that. Most of the time, you know, we're engaged in discussion prior to making any change for, you know, what could be as little bit as a few hours for a situation we're, you know, all in tune with. To, you know, I think one time it took us a month, you know, to really come to terms with a big change that we wanted to make in the portfolio.
And your colleagues are, for folks that aren't intimately familiar with New River, Connor Sen in Georgia, David Shawell in North Carolina, Matt Busegan in New York/Florida.
That's correct.
So you can follow all those guys on Twitter if you're interested, at Connor Sen, at David Shawell, and at M. Busegan. We're getting near to the end here. We always like to close out with a segment called Trading Rich and Trading Cheap. It's not, you know, stock picking. I'm not going to ask for, you know, what you think on a given asset class, but more just what you think about the world. So right now, you've actually lived in Barcelona, so it'd be interesting to hear your take on this. Is Catalan independence trading rich or trading cheap?
I think it's trading rich.
You don't think they're going to be able to escape from Rajoy and co?
I think that the fact that we're calling it escape shows, you know, where that narrative is. I think, you know, cooler heads will prevail. And people will realize that, you know, much like in the case of Brexit, you know, carving out a sovereign state out of another one is not a simple thing.
No, it's definitely not. Once you give up sovereignty or you know, join a new sovereign body, it's tough to unglue it. The conversation I was having about this with the euro and how people think about it is, you know, why does someone from Oklahoma think of someone in Hollywood as, you know, an American? Well, because we're Americans. It's just how we think about it. Breaking down those bonds is a lot more challenging, I think, than people tend to give it credit for. So I would definitely agree. You have lived in LA for 4 years now. I know you love LA itself. What about I got to phrase this correctly. I know LA is a great place to live, and my brother actually lives there too. But do you think LA's influence in culture is trading rich or trading cheap? I say that, you know, we've got the allegations towards Harvey Weinstein. We've got, you know, what's perceived by many as a backlash against sort of traditional liberal values that Hollywood especially espouses a lot of the time going on with the current president. There's just sort of all these cross currents. Do you think that's all just noise and that LA is going to be as important as ever? Or do you think that LA's day in the sun has passed?
I think LA's day in the sun has not begun. What a lot of people, you know, perceive as LA is a very, very, very small, I mean, maybe it's a notable minority, but it's a very small part of LA. And LA is, it's a very, very rich multicultural city. We have, you know, diasporas from all across the world. It's the intersection of many different cultures in the Southwest of the United States, you know, whether they are people from South Asia, Southeast Asia, or Northeast Asia, you know, as well as the Hispanic populations, not just Mexican, but you know, from various central countries in Central America as well. And of course, you know, the myriad of transplants from elsewhere in the United States. I think, you know, if people think that there's that what you're seeing on TV or in the news right now is LA culture, I would argue, you know, you've never gotten to see what LA culture actually is.
The thing that's always struck me visiting LA is how different it is from one part of town to the next. So, you know, Venice Beach is like a completely different world from, you know, even something like Santa Monica. They're both relatively wealthy areas right on the water, but they're practically adjacent and they feel like completely different cities, even though they're, you know, right there. So I think that's definitely something that people that don't spend a lot of time in LA don't really pick up on, is how diverse the city is, you know, equally diverse as any other major city around the world, if not more so. The last one we'll ask you, and I'm hoping to get a nice vitriolic answer out of you here, because I think you have strong feelings on this one. Is the Phillips curve trading rich or trading cheap?
I think everybody should go basically max long and, you know, lever up their parents' house to buy the Phillips curve. The relationship between the cost of labor and its scarcity is not going away. I don't understand why people keep insisting that somehow labor is the one thing that doesn't respond to supply and demand dynamics, where, you know, like tighter markets will lead to higher prices. The Phillips curve is real, and it's not going anywhere. And, you know, if you want to argue about it some more, you know, you're welcome to lose a bunch of money doing it.
Just for anyone that isn't a macroeconomics nerd, the Phillips curve is the sort of dominant framework that most central bankers, most economists use to think about the interaction between the supply of labor the supply and demand of labor and inflation. So if the unemployment rate's low, inflation should be higher, all else equal, is the most simplistic expression of this. And the Fed clearly believes in the Phillips curve and has been resolute in that belief. Others, less faith. So it'll be interesting to see how things play out over the next, I don't know, couple years, I guess.
I'll hedge my bets by saying that, you know, we talk about it as being the Phillips curve, but it's really a, you know, multidimensional surface, and that,
oh, of course,
you know, explains the relationship of labor scarcity to, you know, changes in the price of things, you know. And in that term, I think we've had other variables that have, you know, made it hard for us to assess how much labor scarcity was feeding into inflation. I think that's over. And I expect for us to, you know, start seeing those changes, you know, not only in the coming years, but maybe even in, you know, the coming months. You know, just as a final note, I just wanted to bring up something to your attention. As you know, one of my primary focuses when doing research is tracking the relationship of wages and income taxes. In particular, most of my focus goes into individual income and employment taxes that are withheld. You know, so if you've ever gotten a paycheck and had some money taken out of it and sent to the government before you ever got a chance to see it, that's, you know, what we're tracking. This is a number that we track.
And that's published. That's published daily in raw form by the Treasury.
Yeah, it's published daily in raw form by the Treasury. It never has any revisions, and it is, you know, the absolute final say. We've found over time that a properly adjusted time series of this data will give you basically the closest indication you will get to, you know, how much money people are actually making. It also, in combination with the national income and production accounts data, allows you to compute what is the effective tax rate for households in America as a collective. And one of the developments that we've had since, you know, starting with January 2016, was that we started seeing the effective tax rate go up from, you know, from 28% to a little bit over 29% a couple months ago. which, you know, it's a big jump. You know, if you have wage growth that is, you know, maybe say like 2%, and, you know, you're losing 1%, like a full percentage point of that to an increased effective tax rate, you know, you're only really getting to keep one after tax. And, you know, one of these measures that we've been tracking is, you know, take out the whole of wages and salaries dispersed, and we're subtracting the amount of income and employment taxes withheld from that to kind of get an idea of what the total is for what people are getting in their paychecks. I mean, there's going to be some noise in there because, you know, whether you're, you know, having some money, you know, taken out for your 401k or health insurance or whatever, well, that's not going to show in this data. But when you, you know, kind of take these two numbers and then adjust it for inflation and then adjust it once more by the employment level. And by the employment level, I mean the household surveys employment level, which measures people, not the establishment surveys employment level, which measures the number of positions. This prevents you from falling down, you know, the trap of noise introduced by people that have more than one job. And what we found here is that, you know, ever since basically June of 2016, growth of, you know, real after-tax wages dispersed per employee have been running negative. And ever since about May of this year, we started getting to like a pretty deep negative space. So even though we have, you know, more people earning more money and more jobs, what we're seeing is that at a micro level, an increase in taxes is eating most of that gain, and inflation is eating the rest.
So what's the increase in taxes that came into effect in June of 2016? Like what's the statutory driver of that?
It's not really necessarily a statutory change. People no longer qualifying for earned income tax credits, or the fact, you know, we have upward sloping income tax curves, you know, progressive income tax curves in the United States. And so, you know, as people's incomes go up, you know, the amount of taxes they pay go up. And so as a whole, we've seen that number climb up. And so, you know, the amount of money that ends up, you know, in the hands of the government is growing. And normally that's not really a problem because, you know, the government will just spend it and, you know, recycle it back into the economy and everything will be good. But when you have an administration that, you know, institutes something like a hiring freeze, you're, you know, not letting that money, you know, get back into the economy. And so I think one of the most important things that anybody involved in capital markets should be paying attention to is the fiscal response coming over the next, you know, 6 to 12 months, because, you know, the growth in, you know, in payrolls and in wages is not going to drive us forward right now, at least not while we have this fiscal drag in place. You know, without a more accommodating fiscal impulse, whether that be from, you know, stimulus spending or from an increase in the payrolls of government employees, we're not gonna be able to drive that top line growth, you know, because you're gonna have workers, households as a whole, you know, like corporations are gonna be, say, you know, spending an extra $100 billion a year paying households, and the households are gonna, you know, remit 29% of that to the government. And then, you know, they're going to save a couple percentage of that. And what that leaves is that the increase, you know, the plausible increase in revenue for the corporate sector is less than their increasing expense in terms of labor expenses. So, you know, that I think that's a relationship that you really need to watch, because at this point, the only thing that is going to drive corporate profit margins at the macro scale, right? We're not talking about individual companies. We're talking about the macro scale of, you know, the aggregate of the whole economy, is that fiscal response.
In other words, the it's not that the taxes are too high necessarily. It's that they're not being recycled back into the economy. That's the issue.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really care. You cut the taxes if you want, or you can increase the spending if you want. You know, at the macro identity level, you know, it's pretty much the same. As long as you know, we have either one or the other, we'll be able to manage that. But without it, we're putting households into kind of a difficult situation where a higher amount of optimism may have people spending a little bit more money, even though their real after-tax take-home is, you know, not necessarily growing that fast, and in many cases is probably, you know, diminishing. So I think that puts a lot of people at the risk of accidentally finding themselves overextended or in a fragile position where, you know, some kind of shock could leave them in a financially precarious place, you know, which could eventually translate to a demand shock.
So that's in other words, over the next year or so, keep an eye out for the consumer, because the gas tank is not looking as strong as it has in recent years.
Yeah, that's basically it.
Well, on that relatively negative note, we'll have to leave it there. Guillermo Roditi Dominguez, thank you very much for joining us tonight, and we really appreciate having you on.
All right, it's been a pleasure, George. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us this week on the BespokeCast. Once again, I'm Bespoke Investment Group's macro strategist, George Perks. If you enjoy BespokeCast, please consider reviewing the podcast in the iTunes Store or on your favorite podcast platform. Reviews help us gain visibility and also help us improve the podcast in future episodes. If you'd like to learn more about our firm, please visit bespokepremium.com and follow us on Twitter at @BespokeInvest. Our research includes reports, analysis, commentary, and data sets sent out daily. Special thanks to the Free Music Archive for the music featured in this episode. The track is called Marathon Man by Jason Shaw and is made available under the Creative Commons license. Please visit freemusicarchive.org for more information. Copyright 2017, Bespoke Investment Group, LLC. The information herein was obtained from sources Bespoke Investment Group, LLC believes to be reliable, but we do not guarantee its accuracy. Neither the information nor any opinions expressed constitute a solicitation of the purchase or sale of any securities or related instruments. Bespoke Investment Group, LLC is not responsible for any losses incurred from any use of this information.